Our speaker this afternoon is Dr. Keith Scoville, who is chairman of the Department of Hebrew and Semitic Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has a forthcoming book from Baker Bookhouse, which I'm sure you want to see, called Biblical Archaeology in Focus. And he's going to develop some of the topics in that text under the title, The Limitations of Biblical Archaeology. Dr. Scoville.
Thank you, Professor Jennings, and good afternoon to all of you. We've had a busy day. Last night we had a meeting of our Madison Biblical Archaeological Society with Dr. David Noel Friedman as our guest speaker. This morning we had an early session of our graduate seminar, which Professor Mansour and I share the chairing of, and Professor Friedman was there. Then, after some further hasty preparations for coming down here, I had a class at 11 o'clock, which we let out 5 minutes early with the gratitude of the students, and then we got in the car and came on down here. We did have time to get here, just time enough to have a cup of coffee, or I had some Russian tea. I don't know what that recipe has to do with Russia, but anyway, the tea was very good. It's my pleasure to be here and to share with you some ideas and some considerations that I have about biblical archaeology, and this, in fact, is drawn in part from one chapter in the text, which will be coming out from Baker, hopefully in January. But I'd like also, since we have people here who are interested and are active archaeologists, to respond to any of these ideas, whether it be a positive or negative, and I'd appreciate that. There is in our day a need for a proper perspective of the total archaeological enterprise in which the limitations of biblical archaeology are recognized. The need for such a perspective is evident when one realizes the impressions that the general public receives when archaeological discoveries are published in the popular press. A good example of this is the work of the Italians at Tel Mardik in Syria, which, of course, most of us know by the name Ebla, and the discovery there of about 20,000 clay tablets dating back into the period about 2400 to 2250 B.C. In one newspaper account, the discovery of the Ebla tablets are said to have shed new light on the history of the Jewish people. And this statement is attributed to Professor Pettinato, who is involved in the reading of the text. In fact, even if one considers that the history of the Jewish people begins with the patriarch Abraham, the Ebla texts predate the patriarchs by half a millennium. And so it seems a little bit much to say this will throw new light on the history of the Jewish people. Another statement in the newspaper account indicated that the value of the tablets was $15 million. And that falls flat on its face, too, when you realize no one can really put a monetary value on a discovery like this. Another report mentioned that a king of the Eblite dynasty bore the name Ebrum. The name was immediately associated with Abraham's ancestor, Eber, who is mentioned in the Bible. By way of contrast, one can read Dr. Pettinato's reports, where it is noted that the resemblance of the king of Ebla's name to Eber of Genesis 10:21 is truly surprising. It's the resemblance that is surprising. But, of course, the newspapers don't say that. Of course, nowhere does Dr. Pettinato even suggest that the discoveries will throw light on the history of the Jewish people. The Eblite report illustrates how the popular press, in their search for the sensational, far too often treat probabilities as facts and possibilities as certainties. Far too many people who are largely uninformed about the real nature of archaeological research and who are inexperienced in interpreting newspaper accounts of archaeological discoveries, do not realize the fragile nature of the, quote, assured results, unquote, of archaeological research. These results are really only man's attempts to piece together the story of the human race from meager clues that have survived the ravages of time, meager clues which man has been able to recover. In this whole process, three factors are intricately involved: the Bible, archaeology, and the archaeologist. And each of these has its own peculiarities and limitations that affect the total phenomenon that we call archaeological research, including the final result. I'll address myself first to the limitations of the Bible. The Bible is the surviving literature of ancient Israel. It is a literature characterized by diversity of literary elements and forms: prose and poetry, proverbs and parables, prophetic oracles, and historical narrative, to name a few. But the Bible is more than simply the surviving literature of Israel. It is a unique combination of the secular and the sacred. It contains history, but it is a view of history from a theological perspective. It is a history of the activities of God in the affairs of men as much as it is an account of the activities of men. It contains history, but it is history employed to advance certain theological ideas. The Bible has survived because of the implications of its theological statements rather than the significance of its historical memory of events and men. It has survived through the ages and in spite of its antiquity because it has spoken meaningfully to men through the centuries. It has spoken meaningfully to men, to those who possessed and transmitted it, because it was accepted as the Word of God by those communities of faith who treasured it. At the same time, the Bible does contain history, and these historical sources must be open to the same kind of examination as that to which any other historical source may be subjected. In a sense, then, the Bible contains two kinds of truth: statements of faith and statements of historical fact. Statements of faith, including theological explanations of historical events, such as the cause of the withdrawal of Sennacherib's forces from the siege of Jerusalem in the time of King Hezekiah in 2 Kings 19, these are not susceptible to the same type of inquiry as are the records of historical happenings or persons. Archaeological research cannot be used to prove the Bible in terms of statements of faith. And Nelson Glick, one of the great American archaeologists of this century, has indicated, "The Bible is first and foremost a theological document whose single and unifying purpose, however disparate the component parts of its total mosaic may be, is to portray the nature of God as the God of Israel, of all mankind, of the entire universe, and to explain what worship of him involves." Glick went on to add, "Those people are essentially of little faith who seek through archaeological corroboration of historical source materials in the Bible to validate its religious and spiritual insights. The Bible, as a religious work, needs no proof of its inspiration and authenticity. Its truth is timeless and eternally valid. One evidence of this, I think, is its continuing influence, despite the times we live in, on world culture, including our own contemporary American culture. It is important at the same time to realize that archaeological excavations have produced ample evidence to prove unequivocally that the Bible is not a pious forge. But thus far, no historical statement in the Bible has been proven false on the basis of evidence retrieved through archaeological research. At least none has come to my attention. But with equal frankness, it must be noted that there is a lack of evidence from excavations to corroborate some of the historical statements in the Bible, and of course the much noted example is that of Jericho, where the recent excavations of Miss Kenyon failed to locate a late Bronze Age wall or walls that would substantiate the account of the conquest of the city by Joshua and the Israelites. So much for the limitations of the Bible. Let's think next about the limitations of archaeology. Contemporary archaeologists work with three basic interrelated processes in mind. The first is careful stratigraphic excavation. The second is exact and meticulous recording. And the third is comparative interpretation. These procedures are followed as a result of a primary premise, that is, that an object and its significance for history can be understood fully only when it is studied in its archaeological context, that is, in the environment in which it was found. The activities of excavating, recording, and interpreting are carried on by individual archaeologists in connection with specific sites. The late Paul Lapp once poetically portrayed the relationship between the archaeologist and the site as a love affair between an archaeologist and an ancient ruin. Now, a site, as an object of an archaeologist's devotion, can be as puzzling and unpredictable as the behavior of someone we love can be, both tantalizing and demoralizing the lover at various times. Yet, one of the limitations of archaeology is the plethora of sites that have not yet attracted a lover. There are over 5,000 ancient ruins in what is now Israel and Jordan, leaving aside from consideration for the moment the sites in other areas of the ancient world. Most of these Palestinian sites are tells, and of these only a few hundred have attracted excavators. Further, of the excavated sites, only about 30 have attracted major excavations. The remainder of the excavations have been small-scale soundings, emergency clearances, or salvage operations. It is important also to be aware that even the major excavations have failed to touch most of their sites, that is, the totality of the debris that remains there. The total cubic footage that is disturbed by excavation is relatively small. It is apparent, then, that almost 98% of the major ruins of Palestine remain untouched by archaeological expedition. In other words, a massive amount of data remains buried in the dust despite nearly a century of excavations. A minuscule amount of the potential data has been recovered. Another extenuating factor in biblical archaeology is that many of the major excavations were carried out prior to 1936, before the development of more sophisticated techniques that have been employed in excavations since the end of World War II. The results of earlier excavations, therefore, may be somewhat suspect in the result. So, in the case of tells that were excavated when stratigraphic excavation was in its infancy, a few have undergone more recent re-excavation, Megiddo, Jericho, Shechem, Gezer, and even famed Tel El-Hesi, which is now undergoing re-excavation, have been reworked recently. Undoubtedly, the final results of other earlier excavations will be re-evaluated in the future through similar operations. At least that is something to be desired. The limitations of archaeology also extend to the uniqueness of each individual site. Unlike an experiment in chemistry or physics that can be repeated again and again with identical results, as long as the conditions of the experiment are identically controlled, once a tell is disturbed, that part that has been disturbed can never be re-excavated. The experiment cannot be rerun. Each tell also contains its own unique set of problems: the condition of the debris layers, the mixing of material through later intrusions, the existence of gaps in occupation, and so forth. These and other factors determine the simplicity or complexity of the excavation of a particular site. Another aspect of this limitation is the problem of stratigraphical excavation itself. Since Petrie's work at Tel El-Hesi, which established the importance of the principle of stratigraphic excavation, there has been considerable progress made in applying the principles. But no field of human endeavor advances smoothly, nor has the development of this technique. And in archaeology, as in other fields, different individuals do things differently. And if any general statement can be made about archaeologists that is valid, the most certain one is that they are each strongly individualistic. Among archaeologists, no self-respecting individual will feel constrained to excavate his site according to an absolute standard that has been imposed upon him by some exterior source. In archaeology, the flair of the individual must out. There has been, over the years, then, considerable variation in excavation techniques, in methods of recording data, and in determining what data to observe and record. A realistic view of the strengths and weaknesses of current archaeological research should include, then, the relative infancy of the discipline in terms of I've mislaid a page here. in terms of the number of sites excavated, in relation to the potential number of sites, the actual proportion of the excavated sites that have been dug, that is, the amount that has been dug at each site, and the nature of the materials that have been recovered, because these materials are of predominantly inorganic character that have survived the ravages of time. A realistic view must also take into consideration the misinformation that has resulted from past inadequacies in excavating and recording techniques, the misinformation that is slowly being eradicated or corrected by more recent, technically superior excavations. These limitations indicate the importance of the idea of the, quote, present level of information, unquote. There must always be an open-ended quality to archaeological research which permits and encourages the changes in understanding old data that new data require. Now, the archaeologist is an extraordinary individual. I think I'm ready. I really didn't have time to reshuffle my papers after putting these together. The archaeologist is an extraordinary individual who is, at the same time, inevitably a product of his times. And this is what we want to address next, is the problem of the peculiarities of the archaeologist, the limitations of the archaeologist himself. The world in which the archaeologist grows up and in which he functions has left an indelible mark upon him, and it affects not only what he is particularly interested in terms of his archaeological activities, but also how he understands and interprets what he finds. The general validity of this idea can be established by noting that Palestinian archaeology has passed through several phases in which the predominant interests of the investigators have undergone gradual modification. Edward Robinson initiated American involvement in Palestinian research in 1838. The intellectual world in which Robinson lived was only beginning to feel the development of the critical study of the Bible that was underway in Germany. Robinson himself had received training in the Semitic languages and in biblical history and geography under leading German scholars. But there can be no doubt that Robinson and the vast majority of American and European scholars of that time were devout churchmen. They assumed the veracity of the biblical information, both the historical data and the statements of faith. The prevailing influence of the Bible in Western society in the 19th century dominated the work of Robinson and other investigators in the lands of the Bible in that period. Robinson and his companion, Eli Smith, a missionary in Lebanon, were intent upon identifying the places in Palestine of which they had read in the Bible. And that's the reason they went there. To a considerable degree, a devotion to the Bible marked the early archaeologists. It is difficult to ascertain a direct line of correlation between the predominant interests of the world in which the pre-World War I archaeologists grew up and worked, but the Western world of the last half of the 19th century witnessed the introduction of a number of revolutionary ideas. The burgeoning influence of German critical biblical scholarship, for instance, in which the Hegelian philosophy and the idea of the evolutionary development of biblical religion jeopardized many traditional views of the Bible. There was an array of mechanical implements that were being developed in the world toward the end of the 19th century that promised to ease considerably human drudgery. Another aspect of that time, new advances were being made in transportation and in communication, telegraph and radio, that sort of thing. And from the debris also of Mesopotamian mounds, cuneiform documents were surfacing that were going to illuminate the history of ancient Israel's contemporaries. These developments were destined to influence the thought and activities of future generations of Palestinian archaeologists. The three most significant American archaeologists of the 20th century are W.F. Albright, Nelson Glick, and George Ernest Wright. All were active, both, not all were active before, but they were active, these three, either before or right after, they were all active before World War II and have continued actively afterward until the death of the three within the last 10 years. All three had received training in the liberal scholarship of the day, which had derived from the earlier and continuing critical studies of the Bible. Albright said of himself, "I must admit that I try to be rational and empirical in my approach, but we all have presuppositions of a philosophical order." The statement is equally applicable to Glick and Wright, for all three were deeply imbued with theological perceptions which infused their work. Albright, the son of Methodist missionaries, always maintained a vital and sympathetic interest in the implications of archaeological research for the study of the Bible. Believing in the primacy of logical reasoning and the value of systematic collection of factual data, while treating the Bible with the same respect that other ancient documents received. Glick, who was Albright's student, worked with the Bible in hand. He trusted what he called the remarkable phenomenon of historical memory in the Bible. He was an ordained rabbi and president of the prestigious Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati, and which has other campuses. Wright, also a student of Albright, taught first in McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago before accepting the position in Harvard Divinity School, which he retained until his death. These three set the tone for American archaeology in Palestine from the end of World War I until the present decade. Their efforts were aimed toward understanding the Bible and biblical faith within its setting in the ancient world, and in this effort they were joined by many sympathetic students and associates. In recent years, however, a considerable controversy has risen among American archaeologists who work in the lands of the Bible over the appropriateness of the terminology biblical archaeology. Albright had defined that expression as covering the ancient world from Spain to India and from the Sahara northward to the Urals and stretching across time from 9,000 B.C. to A.D. 700, though he thought that even these limits were flexible. Interestingly enough, though, the archaeologists who question the older terminology are younger men. Both the late Paul Lapp, who purposely avoided the expression, and Dr. William Deaver, who forcibly rejects it, were protégés of G. Ernest Wright. The argument presented is against biblical archaeology and in favor of Syro-Palestinian archaeology or some other descriptive term. This is because a number of independent, secularly oriented, national schools of Palestinian archaeology have developed. These schools are divorced from traditional biblical and theological interests and utilize the Bible largely as a document of national history. Another argument that is brought up to substantiate the change of terminology is the broadening scope of archaeological activity in Palestine to include both pre- and post-biblical periods, to include anthropological interests, cultural history, and ancient ecology. There are other arguments, but suffice it to say that Dr. Deaver and others feel that now, quote, for the first time in its history, Syro-Palestinian archaeology is becoming an autonomous discipline, no longer merely an adjunct of biblical studies. Well, what I'm suggesting is that men who dig in the ground, just like men who live in Wheaton, Illinois, or wherever you live, are affected by the world in which they live. What we've seen is a gradual transition from the time of Edward Robinson to our own time, when men who are somewhat younger than I am are now working in archaeological fields, and the world has taken a few turns since the time of Edward Robinson. And I think the influence of the world in which we live of the last 20, 30, 40 years is being reflected in the interests of the archaeologists who are involved in the activity, at least some of them. Now, if the Bible has a singular historical viewpoint, as we've indicated, and if archaeology as a discipline has its limitations, then it must be acknowledged that the most enigmatic element in the interrelationships between Bible, archaeology, and archaeologists is the latter. Without a doubt, Palestinian archaeologists are extraordinary individuals. In support of this declaration, one needs but to consider what the pursuit of archaeological research in Syro-Palestine demands of the individual. He is compelled to leave the circle of family and friends and associates at home to travel thousands of miles across land and sea in order to indulge his compulsion. As a result, he is forced to interrupt other interests and responsibilities in favor of archaeology, and this can place excessive strains, especially upon family relationships. There are few archaeologists who can afford the cost of transporting their families with them to an archaeological excavation. Most of them go it alone. Such separations and strains have destroyed marriages. In addition, the absence of the archaeologist from home occurs during the most pleasant time of the year for inhabitants of Western Europe, Britain, and Canada, and the United States, the areas from which most foreign archaeologists who come to work in Israel and Jordan come from. Summer is the normal season for archaeological expeditions in Palestine, when rain does not hamper the operation, so the archaeologist spends his summer working on a hot, dry, desolate mound, attempting to wrest whatever bits of information exist from the dust of the past. Again, the extraordinary character of the archaeologist is evident when one observes that, almost without variation, archaeologists have earned advanced degrees that have entailed long years of concentrated study. The majority of them hold doctoral degrees. Often he or she, and there are women in archaeology, and my use of the masculine pronoun shouldn't bother anyone. It's not intended to be anti-women or anything like that. Often he or she, the archaeologist, is a professor in a college or university who spends the greater part of the year in a pleasant and placid setting of academia. Perhaps I should rephrase the pleasant and placid. Well, it really isn't all that placid, but pleasant, I guess, in terms of our environment. But the compulsion to dig is powerful enough to lead the archaeologist to forsake the comforts and convenience of normal living circumstances at home for the frequently harsh surroundings of camp life on a dig. Another factor which indicates the unusual qualities of the archaeologist is of an economic nature. Few archaeologists earn a living as field archaeologists. For most, the activity costs rather than pays. There are excavations where staff members receive no more than transportation, food, and shelter in exchange for their contribution of labor and expertise. The initiator of an expedition faces the awesome economic task of raising the necessary financial backing for the project. This requires exceptional audacity, for he must convince people who control capital funds that the money should be used for digging rather than for more profitable investments. The effort also requires extreme tenacity, for the search for funds must continue in the face of disheartening refusals until some benefactor is found. The organizer also bears the primary responsibility for negotiating with the host country for the authorization to excavate. He has to obtain the supplies for excavation. He has to provide the local transportation arrangements, shelter and food for the people who are going to be there, and take care of their health when they get there. Finally, the responsibility for the preparation of preliminary and final reports are his. Final reports, of course, are published books, but they are technical publications that do not earn large royalties, for the market is small, so there is little financial reward for publishing archaeological reports. It is only the occasional individual who can write a popular account of an excavation and realize a profit from his efforts. Now I have to get back here to the right page again, if you'll excuse me. All right, just a moment. Now, the archaeologist has to undergo all of these kinds of activities in his preparation. He's an extraordinary individual, is the point. Now that we get him to the side, then we are involved in the process of excavating and of classifying data and interpreting on the field. And here is where the role of the archaeologist becomes a matter of limitation. The matter involves the process of interpretation. It is obvious that careful stratigraphic excavation and meticulous recording can produce tangible artifacts that are meaningless until they are interpreted. It is equally obvious that this is the most subjective aspect of the entire enterprise because of the incomplete and fragmentary nature of the surviving remains, and especially because of the complexity of the human element, the interpreter. Interpretation has been called an art with the interpreter as the artist. And as with an artist, the interpreter brings all that he or she is to the task, including one's educational background, experiences in life, philosophical presuppositions, and one's views about the Bible. Despite the subjectivity that permeates the process, the interpretation of archaeological data is an absolute necessity if any meaning is to be derived from the activity and the ultimate end towards which the work proceeds. The fragmentary nature of the evidence requires inferences be drawn, that hypotheses be presented. There are archaeologists who believe that their task is solely to present the evidence which they have excavated, leaving the task of interpretation to other specialists. Fortunately, these comprise a small minority whose interests are in perfecting archaeological methodology rather than in comprehending history. The majority of Near Eastern excavators, by contrast, pursue an ongoing interpretation of the materials they are excavating while the field work is in progress. This approach permits changes in interpretation of the material as new data comes to the surface. Such in-the-field interpretation is grounded in a thorough knowledge of comparative materials from earlier excavations, as well as of the extant historical sources for the area in which the person is working. The final publication of most excavators will contain a detailed interpretation of the material remains of a site with any correlation to written sources that may have been perceived. In Palestine, the correlations are primarily made with the Bible, but of necessity, they are almost invariably hypothetical. The archaeologist presents an hypothesis that, in his judgment, best explains the available data. This hypothesis is open to further modification or rejection upon the basis of later discoveries or as a result of the critical comments of fellow archaeologists. Interpretation, then, is an explanation of probabilities or possibilities for dating the accession of Solomon, for instance, about 961 B.C., the accession of the Israelite king Jehu, based on a stele that was discovered in Nineveh, 841 probably is the date of Jehu's takeover of the government of Israel and the killing at that same time of the king of Israel and the king of Judah. An important synchronism then in biblical history. The fall of Samaria has been established, 722 or 721 B.C., and the first capture of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar's forces has been established as March 15th or 16th, 597. These dates, in turn, provide a framework for the chronology of the kings of Judah and Israel. For those periods in which no synchronisms have been discovered, a relative chronology has been worked out in considerable detail based upon pottery dating techniques. In contrast to our present state of knowledge concerning biblical chronology, in the 17th century, Archbishop Usher of Dublin worked out a chronological table from the biblical information that placed creation at 4004, the flood at 2348, Abraham's birth at 1996, and the Exodus at 1491. But Usher did not take into account that such a figure as 40, which is found repeatedly in the scriptures, was simply a way of rounding off a generation of human life. He could not effectively account for the reigns of various kings who reigned for less than a year. Biblical writers simply did not leave sufficient information for the construction of accurate table of dates. Archaeology can and does clarify many points of biblical chronology. Archaeology has provided material evidence that illuminates life in biblical times. Through the excavation of biblical sites, a great deal has been learned of the nature of and development of ancient architecture. The form and content of houses, of palaces, temples, stables, and city walls and gates are now quite well known. We have a much clearer picture of what the Solomonic temple looked like because similar Canaanite temples, which have been excavated, exhibit the same general plan. Much more could be said about the illumination of religious ideas and practices of the ancient world, practices and ideas against which the prophets spoke. The archaeologist has uncovered ancient literatures with which the biblical literature can be compared and contrasted. And even the story of the development of writing has been wrested from the ancient soil so that we now know for a certainty that Moses lived in a literate society. Archaeology has provided illumination, illustration, and occasionally confirmation of biblical data, but its primary contribution has been illumination. For many years to come, archaeological research will no doubt continue to illuminate the Bible, thanks to that extraordinary individual of whom we've noted the limitations, the one to whom we extend our word of commendation, the archaeologist. Thank you.